1990, he is focused on making science accessible to non-scientists through books and articles, etc. And then Amy Fox grew up in Boulder. She's written several feature films, including her most recent one, Equity, and that film will be screened tonight in this very venue, so at 5 o'clock. So if you're if you want to come and I don't know if there would be popcorn, but anyway. So that's and she, did I mention she grew up in Boulder, which is also good. So, okay, Michelle.
Here so early. I think my opening is going to sort of be two parts. I want to talk to you a bit about some of the strategy that we use at NASA to involve art and artists and why we do that. And then I'd like to also kind of then become a little bit more general and talk about what I think are a lot of misperceptions about the separation between art and science. And indeed, that if we ever hope to actually have a more diverse scientific workplace and a more diverse environment of ideas in science, we need to much more deliberately include art in that. A slightly outdated bio, no problem at all. I'm actually the deputy director of science at NASA headquarters now. My specialty is science communication. And as an astrophysicist, one of the things that my career took me in a way that I wasn't quite expecting, I have to be a spokesperson for all aspects of NASA science now. And I love that. I mean, if any of you saw me at the planetarium, I was having a great time with pictures of Saturn. You know, Saturn is not my specialty, but I thought they were so beautiful that people had to see them. And people had to just sit back and enjoy them. And not, I didn't want to tell you all about the exact specifications and the exact measurements. I wanted you to appreciate the aesthetics of what it was to have an observatory that's been around Saturn for the last 15 years and will die on September 15th of this year, rather dramatically. I think that the thing that surprised me most about the way my career's gone is that one of the things I'm very proud of at NASA is our Earth Science Program. We have hundreds and hundreds of scientists working on the study of our home planet. That's part of our purview in the universe. The Earth is included. And we realized that we were not getting our message across to the public well at all about the changes that Earth was going through, about the importance of these. And simply bringing more and more facts to the table was not working. We were failing. We could see that. So how could we get people to listen to us more, to feel more involved in our science, to feel that it was not just the sage on the hill telling somebody, you know, think this? And one of the things we did is we turned to artists. And at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, we've had an artist in residence for the last 20 years. Now, let me just back up a little bit. We have plenty of data visualization graphic artists who help us visualize the terabytes of data that come in every day. Visualizations of ocean currents and the atmosphere of Jupiter and, you know, the galaxies of the Hubble Space Telescope. We have lots of people that have an art background that specialize in scientific data. But Dan Goods at JPL is something different. He's a fine artist. And his instructions are not to help us produce a really good map of a nebula from Hubble, but to actually make fine art projects and installations that bring the public more into our work. And you know, one of the things that he did that I thought was very effective is the way we find planets around other stars is we look for transits. We look for the planets to pass in front of the star and make a tiny little eclipse, and you see a little bit of a shadow, you know, a little dark spot going across the star. And in several locations, he put at night, you know, in Santa Monica or in Pasadena or in New York, there was a large wall that was lit very brightly. But as people walked by and they cast shadows on that wall, all of a sudden they could see that in the dark space of their shadow, there were planets and pictures and there was movement. And we saw people banding together to make bigger shadows so they could see more of the picture. And then we could talk to them about how we do this. There's an installation currently in Los Angeles where you sit in a giant shell-shaped, it's actually made of kind of raffia. It's made of this wonderful kind of natural organic material. And you sit inside this giant cochlear shell and you listen to real data about where all of our spacecrafts are around you. You hear them pass over. And it's real. The data is actually true as to where those spacecraft are around the Earth. And you just listen. Right now we have 108 active spacecraft up there. You listen to them pass around you, and you think about what human beings are capable of. So we've taken our outreach to fine artists very seriously. I'm working with Eric Whitaker, who's a very famous choral director. He does these giant virtual choirs where he has people actually YouTube sing a piece of a choral piece, and then he puts it all together. And his latest one was 5,000 people. It's closer to 6,000 people all across the world singing. He's doing a piece about the Hubble Deep Field, a very deep galactic survey of the Hubble Space Telescope. So we're trying to encourage more involvement, and part of it is fun, and part of it is for inspiration, and part of it, honestly, is out of desperation. We need people to actually respond to our science in a more emotional way. So we take that very seriously. But the other thing is that I think that a lot of the cultural divide between the arts and the sciences, and also how we educate people, they're supposed to be very separate. There's a science personality and there's an art personality. This has been one of the most harmful things in my personal life. You know, when I was a curious young girl growing up in rural Wisconsin, I loved the arts. I was very good at the visual arts. I loved dancing. I was very good in choir and all of that. And they kept telling me, you don't have the personality to be a scientist. You're not the right type of person to be a scientist. Scientists are dispassionate and not emotional and very, very logical. And all my life I have struggled against this box that I was put into, because I am emotional and I like the arts and I feel the value in that sort of human expression. And it's such a false difference. You know, scientists often don't like to admit that the way that we work is not really the scientific method you've heard of, where it's all very logical, step-by-step, experimentation, hypothesis, come back and experiment some more. A lot of us kind of feel our way through it. And our sense of aesthetics and our sense of elegance can tell us a lot about whether the mathematics or the theory that we're working with is true. And that's a difficult thing to quantify, so it makes people a little bit nervous that science could have a bit of that in it. And of course, the end point of science is to make something that everyone can replicate. We can all do the experiment and get the same results. Anyone with a telescope anywhere in the world can look up at a galaxy and see the same galaxy. We understand the value of that formalism. But it's not really how scientific discovery works. Our aesthetics tell us something very deep about the universe. We do not understand how the human brain works, but we know it evolved in the universe we find ourselves in. We don't know why we respond to the golden ratio. We don't know why mathematics has to be elegant. And what does that mean? So the differentiation of science and art is not only artificial, it's harmful in a diversity sense. You know, you don't tell a child who loves to dance and is very emotional that they can't do science. That's absolutely bullshit. There's nothing different about learning advanced quantum mechanics than there is about learning a different language. There is not a science personality. And if we ever hope to really move on and make this a more diverse and more inclusive world, we've got to break those barriers down, those barriers of perception that have been put up there just by culture and not by the universe. Thank you.
Great point.
Some excellent points. Thanks. Sydney?
Good morning, everybody. I'm really amazed that people show up early or stay late for panels here. So thank you for doing it. I don't know how much coffee you had to drink to get here, but you're here. That's the main thing. No one on this panel thinks that the combination of science and art is a bad thing. You can be sure of that. We all agree on that. But the really interesting point is how they come together and which one influences which one. Does science lead the art? Does art lead the science? Or do they share equal roles in it? I want to talk today a little bit about something that's very central to artists that yet has a huge scientific input. So it's a place where the two areas really join. And although it can be magical, it also has some issues. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the issues. And the thing that is so important to scientists, to artists is, what medium do I work in? You know, painting as an artistic form goes back 15 or 20,000 years. We had cave painters in France and other places who had to scrounge to find ways to express what they wanted to. They used burnt charcoal for black, and they found some earth that looked red to make the red color and so on. These were the first pigments, and that was the first medium. Then we got more sophisticated. We developed oil paints. Then we developed acrylics. Then we got really interesting. In 1960, the laser was invented. And all before the scientists were done inventing it, just 2 or 3 years later, artists were already saying, oh, here's a brand new medium. I can use light as a medium. Of course, every artist responds to light, but actually being able to manipulate light was brand new. So I want to talk about media as the place where science and art exist. And I said before, there are areas where that's not so simple. It's a little bit complicated. And I'm going to talk about two kinds of media where it gets complicated, biological media and nanotechnological media. And I'll give you examples of each. What are biological media? Well, this comes under a heading of an area that's very hot these days, bioart, which has different definitions, but it basically means you can use living things or pieces of living things, all the way from cells up to whole animals, to create works that can be considered art. And just to give one example, there's a very nice operation out of Australia, which has been going for 20 years, and I want to get the name straight if you want to look it up online. It's called the Tissue Culture and Art Project. Tissue Culture and Art Project. And their manifesto is they will use tissue technology as a medium for artistic experimentation. Great example of the art and the science developing together, because tissue culture is also a new thing. So they're following each other, as I said before, often happens. Here are some of the things they've made, just to give you a taste of what this kind of medium can do or not do. In Guatemala, there's a tradition of worry dolls. They're little dolls, very crude looking, that are given to children that are supposed to solve their problems overnight if they sleep with the doll. So this tissue and culture project has made semi-living worry dolls. They're made out of human bone and muscle tissue, ground up into kind of a paste, built around a plastic armature, and turned into kind of a crude doll. They call them semi-living. I think that's a stretch, but at least you can say they were once living. Well, this is a brand new kind of medium, and it raises all kinds of ethical questions. Is this a good thing to do with human parts? You know, this is not so different from worrying about whether stem cell experimentation has a moral component to it or not. On the other hand, the same operation, the same tissue culture artistic operation, raises its own ethical questions. They have a project, and again, I want to get the name straight, called Victimless Leather. The idea is, instead of killing an animal to make leather for a coat to a human to wear, could you somehow grow a coat just from today's biotechnology that would be entirely human-made, would not involve killing an animal, and therefore would be a much more ethical form of leather. So here's one place where the science and the art come together, raising moral questions, but also maybe providing some moral answers or ethical answers. Really a very deep connection. The other area I said I'd talk about is nano art, and this is really interesting to me because I just wrote a piece about it. I really got into it very deeply. There's a company in the UK which is expert at making carbon nanotubes. If you don't know what these things are, they would look like a pen, if you can see my pen, but the dimensions of it would be only a few atoms across and maybe 100 or 1,000 atoms long. They're really, really tiny. So what this company does is take billions of these and mount them vertically on a flat surface, say a piece of aluminum. They make what looks like a little nano forest, if you imagine each of these is a tiny tree. When light hits this nano forest, it gets absorbed by all these billions and billions of trees. So what this company has done is to produce a product called Vanta Black, which is the blackest black ever made. It absorbs something like 99.7% of all the light shining on it. If you look at something coated with this stuff, it's like literally looking into a black hole or looking out to infinity. It reflects nothing. An ordinary black paint, if you paint it on a three-dimensional surface, won't be quite flat. It'll show some glints and highlights here and there. You know there's something three-dimensional behind it. This stuff, if you look at it, absolutely flat, matte black. It's quite eerie. This is one time, I'm sorry, I can't use a visual aid here, because I would love to show it to you. It's really striking. Okay, so as soon as artists heard about it, they got revved up. And there's a very famous sculptor named Anish Kapoor. Has anyone here heard of Anish Kapoor? Yeah, he's quite well known. He's really a brilliant sculptor. He operates in England. He heard about Vanta Black, and he came up with this fantastic idea. He's going to build a huge steel structure, big enough for several people to walk into it, coat the inside with Vanta Black. So when you're inside and look out, It looks like you're looking out to the ends of the universe. This is something that would really be great for astronomical demonstration, among other things. And people love the idea. He hasn't built this yet, but I love the idea. So other artists got doubly revved up when they heard about this, and they said, this is wonderful. Where can I get my hands on some of this stuff? Well, here's the kicker. Anish Kapoor has signed a contract with the company that makes the stuff that grant them exclusive rights to its use. So artists got understandably upset about this. On the other hand, the technology to make this stuff, which, by the way, also has military and commercial value, is very expensive. The company is not going to give it away to just anybody. So it's a great example, again, of art and science, or at least art and technology, colliding, and what is behind the technology, the corporate and the commercial interest, makes it not so expansive for artists, but maybe even more limiting to artists because it frustrated them so much. So I want you to mull over these two examples of where science and art work, but in much more complicated ways than we think they automatically do. Thank you very much.
Okay, Amy.
Hi, I want to thank my panelists because I come from a more narrow place to this topic, and it's just fascinating to hear from both of you. And I was particularly moved by what you said, Michelle. My daughter's here in the audience, and she loves art and science. They're her two favorite things, and I hope she heard your words about that they're not mutually exclusive. So I'm a writer, primarily a playwright and a screenwriter. But I have always been surrounded by scientific personalities. I was born into a family. My father is a physicist, now retired from IBM. My oldest brother became an astrophysicist. Something about that personality must feel comfortable to me because then I married someone who's also from a very scientific family. So his father's a horticulturist, his brother's also a physicist, and my husband has sort of a similar job as Michelle, works in science communication. So I only share that because I think that there is something very, if they're not, perhaps they're the same personality as you said, but if there are differences in the artistic personality and the scientific personality, I think there are many overlaps, and I'm certainly drawn to that way of seeing the world, even though it's not my own way of seeing the world. So in my own work, I've done a lot of projects that don't have anything to do with science, but I've also had the fortune to work a lot with the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and they fund not only science itself, but they have a program which funds specifically theater and film about science. And I've worked with them in a couple of ways. They have funded two of my projects so far and hopefully are going to fund a third. We'll see. And they run programs through different arts institutions. So the Sloan Foundation themselves doesn't feel that their staff and their director, he doesn't feel that he's in a position to fully evaluate artists and artists' proposals the way that they can for science, and so they work with institutions. So they work with Sundance Film Festival, they work with Tribeca Film Festival to kind of seek out who are the artists that they should be commissioning, and they work with schools. So I also teach in the grad film school at NYU, and Sloan has funded many of our students' projects, and I'm part of that committee where basically what we do is reach out to our students to figure out which ones are interested in science, what kind of proposals do they have, and then help vet those for Sloan and pair up the students with the funding. And it's been interesting. It's had very mixed results. Some extraordinary films have come out of it, and it's also kind of shown me some of the gaps between those worlds, and there are many students who are very talented and extraordinary filmmakers, but seem kind of daunted by taking on a scientific project and want to use it as a metaphor. But if we actually ask them to meet with a scientist, do the research, to actually bring real science into their project, sometimes that works beautifully and sometimes it's more challenging. So it's been kind of interesting to watch that process. What's interesting to me about the Sloan mission, and I'm not a spokesperson for them, but is that their goal is simply to have more diverse characters and explorations of science in public media. So I think initially they were bothered by the fact that many people can't distinguish science from science fiction, which continues to be true because They very explicitly say in their materials, we don't fund science fiction, and still I'd say more than half the proposals we get are science fiction. Secondly, they were frustrated with the perception in many films that and plays, but more, you know, of this mad scientist, this crazy mad scientist character who generally doesn't behave much like a real scientist. They really wanted to, they believed that there was something inherently dramatic and inherently interesting for a dramatist in actual science and people doing actual science, and so that became something they wanted to fund. So it's been very illuminating to work with them. I'll just tell you a tiny bit about the projects I've done with them. So the first project I did was based on, I became really interested in orchids and people that work with orchids. And so I did a play that was a woman who was really obsessed with orchids and had her own greenhouse. And basically her research into the reproductive mechanisms of orchids, she sort of reflected that in the way she raised her children. So she had these two daughters named after orchids, and one of the daughters sort of had this habit of luring in men the way that orchids lure in bees, and the other one had actually a different approach. And so anyway, that was my first project I did with Sloan. And they really gave, it was their early days, and they gave us kind of free rein. They liked the idea. They gave me a very small grant to work on it. And I, you know, it just sent me off I was a very young artist, and it sent me in a direction I may not have otherwise gone, which was really fun. The next project I did with them I was inspired by a sort of true crime story. It was a very dark story about a scientist in the 70s who had studied sudden infant death syndrome and had been looking to understand whether there was a genetic component, although he didn't call it a genetic component, he called it a hereditary component, and ended up studying a family where multiple children had died, and it turned out there was a criminal element going on. And what was interesting to me was that when the truth actually came out about the fact that, in fact, these children were not dying of natural causes, this scientist had actually built most of his career on studying this family. He had published the kind of front page article in Pediatrics Journal that had really landed him in his career. And so he, even after the mother was actually sent to jail and confessed that she had hurt these kids, he still was publicly claiming she was innocent because his own trajectory of his career was dependent on believing that what had happened to these kids was hereditary. So that was an interesting character to me. And so I wrote a kind of modern take on that story. And then quite recently I was approached by a producer who has optioned a wonderful book called Trespassing on Einstein's Lawn, which is a memoir of a woman who, as a teenager, she and her father really bonded over physics, and she tells this wonderful story. I'm totally blanking on her name. Do you know her name? Oh. Sorry, I'll come up with it. Anyway, she, when she was a teenager, she was going through her teenage angst, and her father was trying to reach her. And one day he sat down, he said, okay, what's interesting to you? Let's talk about what's interesting to you. And she said, nothing. And he said, okay, let's talk about nothing. And he started getting books out of the library on the science of the physics of nothing, and what is nothingness, and does it exist, and is there, you know, where did the universe come from? Did it come from nothing? And actually she kind of came out of her angst and really got excited, and they pursued it together. And then as an adult, a young adult, just kind of a great story, so I'll just tell it briefly, but she wanted to be a writer. The only job she could get out of college was working for this magazine called Manhattan Bride, and it was run out of some guy's apartment, and so she was there in the apartment, and she saw a advertisement for a physics conference, a major physics conference at Princeton that was studying basically nothingness. And she was quite desperate to find out how she and her father, and he was a medical doctor, he was not a physicist either, how they could get an invitation to this conference. So she picked up the phone and she said, like, I work for Manhattan Bard magazine, and kind of, it's just, they heard Manhattan magazine. She didn't acknowledge that it was actually Manhattan Bride, and she said, I'd like press credentials to this conference, and they gave them to her, and so she was able to go with her dad, and then they kind of continued this search, and they actually they traveled all over the country together, and really worked with the greatest scientific minds, or not worked with them, but interviewed them, talked to them, and sort of pursued this inquiry. And it's a really lovely father-daughter story. So this producer who has optioned the book, interestingly, she's had a hard time finding a writer who is really comfortable writing about science in a really nuanced way. So she actually saw in my bio that I had done a couple, we were at a conference together, she noticed in my bio that I had done some Sloan work and approached me. And so we're now trying to raise the money to adapt that book into a film, which would be really fun.
Well, this is great. It may appear that we have three panelists here, but it's great because we have two scientists and three artists. So we really have five panelists up here, which is great. I just before we get into questions, did any more you'd like to add or ask each other?
I certainly was thinking when Sydney was talking about these sort of semi-living dolls. Some of my responses to that that sort of art/science exhibit body worlds. Oh, sorry. Okay. I'll talk this way. I'm trying to address Sydney, but I'll go this way. There was an exhibition that certainly made a very well-publicized national tour called Body Worlds. And it was made of plasticized bodies. People had donated their bodies. These are people who had died and had said in their will that they agreed to donate their bodies to this installation. And while there were some scientific components to the exhibit, like they would show the entire digestive tract of a person that they'd isolated, or the entire circulatory tract. The thing that was amazing was that there was one that was just the veins of three people. There was a man, a woman, and a child, and the child was on the man's back being carried, as if they were a family walking together, and all there were the veins of three actual people. And there was another one where there was a man who was riding a full-size horse. So they'd done this entire horse, they plasticized. It's done in a vacuum chamber where they actually force plastic into the tissue to replace the water, and then they remove people's skin, so you can't identify them. You don't even know what race they were, often what gender they are. But he was riding this horse and holding forward. He had his brain and his heart, that he was holding forward to you, and it was incredibly powerful. And there was a little bit of me that wondered: is this a good thing? Is this a right thing to do with bodies? But then I was tempted to donate my body at the end. There was a sign-up sheet at the end. Would you like to be part of this? And that reminded me of the questions of ethics and using bodies as art.
That's a great point because, again, artists have always used the human body as something to sculpt or to draw. But now we have technology that gets much more intimate with the body. Mm-hmm. And that's where it really starts to make it scary. You're peeling away layers of what humanity is really like. And yet the older artists did it quite well. There's a drawing I once saw by Leonardo da Vinci. You don't see it often because it's in the private collection of the Queen of England. It is a cross-section of a couple having sex. Can you believe this? He envisioned what the bodies would look like at that moment of connection. So the older artists had the insight, but they didn't have the tools to really lay it out in front of you in a way that a modern artist can do, and that's a huge difference. One other point, Amy's point about the Sloan Foundation wanting to differentiate between science and science fiction, that's really right for what they want to do. They want documentaries that get the science right. But I can never get away from the fact that in the broader world, science fiction, I think, has inspired more people to become scientists than almost any other source you can think of. You want the science fiction to be pretty accurate, that's important. But I would never totally throw it out and say this is a bad thing to have. I think it's quite a good thing to have.
Oh, and I agree completely. It's just not their particular mission.
It's not their thing, right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Okay, great. And just a reminder that if you are asking a question as a student, please indicate that because we do give priority to student questions. So the first question here says, when there are ethical restraints towards the intersection of science and art, is there a need for regulation or consensus between artists and scientists as to how we combine both?
You want to go first?
I'm not tackling that one.
Oh, Lord. If you have something to say, can I help you out?
Yes, there is a need for consensus. And in fact, first you have to get the consensus about the science. Let's get back to genetic science, which is, I think, the most impactful area that we're all concerned about today. And people are just barely beginning to figure out what it means to be able to edit genes in a relatively simple way. There's a huge report just issued, a 300-page report from the National Academy of Sciences, which, as far as the U.S. goes, is the main referee for the ethics of science. And they have said, we need to talk about this, and we haven't begun to find answers. So we don't have answers within science and society. We're certainly not going to get answers within the science and the art. Who could supply those answers? I don't know, but at least the need for the conversation needs to be stated. And I don't think we've even stated that need clearly enough.
Okay, let's see. We've got some student questions here, so let me get to those. But actually, there was an interesting one. I don't know if it's from a student or not. And it says, are you aware that many music majors in the College of Music complete a second degree in the College of Engineering, which represents an integration of art and science? And actually, as a former engineering professor, I can tell you it's interesting that for engineering students, the most common second major, if they do get two majors, is music. Mm-hmm. So that very much goes together.
There's so much that could be said about the technology, you know, of that. I mean, you know, it's the idea of vibrations, right? I mean, and just how deep that goes in physics. You know, I mean, of course, when you're a musician, you get very good at manipulating the vibrations of something. You know, whether it's a stringed instrument or even, you know, a woodwind or brass. You know, it's all about vibrating the air. And you know, one of the for those of you that know some of the corollaries to science, of course, you know, in modern particle physics, all of the different particles that we know of, all the different quarks and leptons, these are all names I'm throwing out to you, but they're basically all the same thing. They're strings of pure energy vibrating at different frequencies. They're the same exact thing, just different vibrations. And you know, recently we were trying to communicate to people what a gravitational wave is. You know, we had these two supermassive black holes. Dead stars, and in the case of these guys, they were both about 1,000 times the mass of the sun, and they collapsed together, and there was this amazing explosion of gravitational energy, and allowed us to detect these gravitational waves for the first time. This was about a year and a half ago, and we were talking about the idea of nothingness, the idea that the universe itself has a sound. It's not, gravitational waves are not carried through a medium like air, a sound wave through air. They're actually waves in space and time. Space and time itself can vibrate. There is a sound to nothingness, to nothing there. No particle, no matter, not even any light. Gravitational radiation. And we're now beginning to look at the universe in this completely new way. We've opened new eyes, or maybe I should say new ears. We've actually opened new ears to the universe and what the sound of the vibration of space and time is. So the intersection between music and engineering and music and physics is very deep indeed.
I wonder if there isn't another answer, and maybe our moderator can answer this. So do you think it might be that engineers by day want to be Clark Kent, the quiet, productive engineers, and by night want to be the Superman rock star? Could that possibly be it?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's the answer. Yeah. Beside the vibrations of the universe, which is also very key.
Okay, a student is curious in how can artists become involved in science and scientists involved in art?
Well, certainly at NASA, we actually have tried to have, honest-to-goodness, internships and fellowships. That's something that gets increasingly difficult to protect politically and the money. And I mentioned our artist in residence at JPL. I've gotten into so many arguments about why we need him, and we need him. So there are some limited opportunities in some government grant programs to pursue this intersection of art and science. There are increasingly a lot of conferences where the two are discussed and the intersection of the two. After this conference, next month, I'm off to a conference sponsored by Cirque du Soleil in Montreal, and it's actually a conference on business innovation and involving the sciences and the arts. So I think young people are breaking down these barriers quite well when it comes to ideas of innovation and creativity and how important creativity itself is to business, to science, to art, to all of that. So I've seen a lot of that happening. There are more and more venues to come together and talk to scientists. If you are interested in including science in art, there are some organizations, especially for writers. There's a big organization that connects scientists to writers specifically, and not just to fact check, also to offer ideas about what might be possible. So those opportunities are out there. Look at the conferences. There's, like I said, limited number of formal grants that are available for that. And, I mean, a good place to start, actually, check out Dan Good's TEDx talk. If you do a search on Dan Good's NASA TEDx, you'll see his TEDx talk on the projects he does for NASA.
There's another great source which is easy to lay hands on. It's a magazine called Leonardo, mm-hmm. named after Da Vinci. It's an art science magazine. It's published at MIT. It has every kind of article you can think of about the interactions between those two areas. It'll give you ideas and people to talk to. And the other path, and I think this applies more to artists trying to reach, trying to reach scientists. What often happens is an artist will approach a scientist may get interested, but he or she really has other stuff they have to do first, often involved with raising money. Mm-hmm. So the art gets pushed to a backseat. If you can get a scientist individually involved and interested, you've won half the battle. And I'm always flattered when an artist approaches me and asks for help or can we share an idea. So if you can find a specific scientist to talk to, that is certainly the way to go.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I is a component of the Sloan program is that they actually give, with our students, they pair them with a science advisor and they give that advisor a small stipend so that it allows them to prioritize working with the artist when they are so busy with so many things. Those are fantastic resources, and this is going to sound really obvious, but I think just simply through reading, starting to read, you know, whether it's like the Science Times and the New York Times, whether it's listening to Science Fridays on NPR or reading Wired magazine. I think for me, because I've always been surrounded by scientists, I've always had those ideas within reach. And then if I do read something and I don't understand it, I've always had someone to ask about it. And one thing I found with our students is that a lot of them, they get excited because we offer grants, and filmmaking students are equally desperate for money as scientists. And so they just hear grant, and they show up, but they say, like, oh, I have to write about science. And you realize that even if it's interesting to them, even if they have a curiosity it doesn't feel accessible to them, and a lot of them, they'll say, like, well, what am I going to write about? And I'll simply say, like, start reading, you know, the Science Times, start listening. And within a few weeks, they come in with all these ideas, but it's just not been part of their frame of reference.
Great. Another student question. I think this is a great question. Has art affected the progress of science?
That's a perennial one, and every time I talk about it, it seems people ask that. Science has certainly affected art. In all honesty, and maybe someone else in the panel has a better answer, I found very few examples where the art, other than inspiring maybe some creativity in a general way, has really made science, has really changed science dramatically. Maybe someone else has an example. There's one very famous one, this is very threadbare, but maybe the audience hasn't heard it, in organic chemistry. There is something called the octane ring, where you have atoms connected in a certain hexagonal form. Chemists worried about that for a long, long time, what the actual geometry was, and the person who came up with the answer dreamt it. He saw it visually. Mm-hmm. So people interpret that as an example, at least, of a visual component, if not quite art, having a dramatic impact on science. But aside from that, hard to come up with. Anyone else have a good example?
I guess I can sort of think about, in some ways, kind of a parallel evolution, and how I think personally, when you think about the advent of things like relativity and quantum mechanics, things that were going on in the early 1900s, where it's one of the most beautiful things about being a physicist. It's also very hard to describe to people who aren't. We're asked to let go of our sense of even causality, the idea that one event causes another. Current modern particle physics asks you to think in 11 dimensions of space and time. And I can't really tell you what another dimension of time is like. I'm a limited four-dimensional creature, and I can't. I mean, somebody at a panel yesterday said, "What's the fifth dimension like?" And I was like, "Boy, would I love to be able to tell you." When you think about what was happening in the arts at the time, and the idea of abstraction and letting go of sort of pure representationalism, and the idea of letting go of what your brain might, in other areas of history, might naturally have thought of as art and science. Non-causality, many dimensions in space. You know, Picasso, you can see many different aspects of a person's physiology all at once. I think that these may have helped scientists let go of this sort of ego-driven view of reality and our idea that we perceive reality. I think that was a parallel evolution. I mean, I think it was sort of happening at the same time. I'm not sure one influenced the other, but I think they were both sort of coming out together.
I'll consider a high school science teacher as a student, which I think is appropriate. As many of you know, one of the buzz in the terms of extra planets being discovered out there was in the so-called TRAPPIST system, named I think after Belgian monks, or because they were Belgian astronomers.
And all the planets are nicknamed after different Belgian ales. Seriously,
yeah. I've heard that too. The question is, how, and probably Michelle probably can answer this one, how accurate are the artist's replications of celestial objects, for example, in the TRAPPIST solar system?
I love that. That is such a great question. So the TRAPPIST system was discovered by this transit method, these tiny little planets that we have never resolved at all. We've never even resolved them into tiny little disks. All the data we have is that the star that they're around gets dim in little patterns of succession. So there's one planet, say, that goes around about every 2 days. They're all very close to their star. And so the star actually dims a little bit every 2 days as this planet goes in front and eclipses it. We've never seen these planets. We have never seen a single exoplanet. There are some giant, very distant exoplanets around stars that are bigger than Jupiter that maybe Hubble has gotten a single pixel of. But we've never resolved the disk of a planet. It's all just very indirect data. And so at NASA, we argue about this. So the artist that I mentioned, Dan, this was one of his more actual sort of representational art projects. He actually made travel posters for all of these planets. So, and then not just the TRAPPIST system, but dozens of other exoplanets. Exoplanets are highly variable. Some are locked with a single day side and a night side. They don't turn on an axis. Others are very hot or very cold. There's one where we found an exoplanet that is not attached to any star. It's just a runaway planet. And he made that one the planet where the nightlife never ends, because there's no star. We argue about this because the public is not satisfied with just seeing a little graph where the light dips every 3 days. That's what we have. That's the data. It's not evocative. It doesn't make you think this is a place you could stand on. It doesn't involve you. So to the best of our physical knowledge, we say, okay, we have some estimate of what the temperature of these planets may be. We don't know if they have atmospheres. We don't actually know if they're tidally locked with one day side or night side or not. We know almost nothing about them. And this was a decision. This was a conscious decision to let our scientists work with the artists, come up with the best guess we could. And some people really worry about that because the public sees these images and thinks that we know that. We know that there are oceans or clouds or deserts. We don't. But I will argue that this is a place where you need to let go, perhaps, of that very, very dry scientific rigor and allow people to become more emotionally involved with your science and their imagination. So we have this argument at NASA. We do our best. We obviously have those artists working very, very closely with the scientists, but they are conjecture, and sometimes the public doesn't realize that.
I'm going to sort of lump a couple of questions there. We've got some great questions from students who seem to be genuinely interested in how can I myself pursue this. So I'll just choose one question, but it kind of captures the essence of several that I've gotten. And the question is it important in these times to specialize in an art form if you have a passion for science or vice versa?
It's such a personal question. I think you have to decide which is your greater passion, or is your mind and your spirit big enough to do them both at the same time? In terms of straight career advice, the career advice to me is pretty clear. The way you get ahead in most careers and most professions is to concentrate hard on one of them, build a base. Maybe it takes 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Then you have the credentials and the wisdom to pursue another branch. I did that, but I had to hit age 50 before I branched off. I'd always wanted to be a scientist, first choice, writer, second choice. So the second choice came into play when I hit 50, which is a good age to take stock of your life. If you're smart, a smart young person, you can maybe make that decision when you're 28 or 32, which would be fantastic. But I think in most situations, whether academic or industrial, putting equal energy into both right at the beginning probably is not a useful way to go. I wonder if anyone would agree or disagree with me.
I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, even within the art world, it's the question of how multidisciplinary can you be, and there are very multidisciplinary artists, but I do think it's really important to have to sort of master, well, we never master anything, but to build a really strong foundation in your craft in one form and then see how it complements and how it crosses over into other forms, even within art. So I would say it's probably what you're saying. It's probably the same with science and with trying to combine the two.
I like the idea of kind of having a sneaky sub-agenda because, you know, I specialized in science. You know, I got a doctorate in straight astrophysics. But I knew I liked communication, and I liked the arts. And then I got a postdoctoral research fellowship at Caltech, and that's when I started working for NASA. And I just kept my eye out for opportunities. Did they need a scientist to go work with a museum? You know, did they need a scientist to advise on a book? Did they need a scientist to work with a local art college? You know, I mean, NASA gets hundreds and hundreds of requests every day. And we have a speakers bureau that tries to kind of farm them out and help people connect with scientists. But honestly, there's just way too many. And so, you know, the idea that you could get yourself formally trained and focus in one of those areas, you're an artist, say, but you keep your eye out, you know, is there a chance to work with somebody on NASA? Is there a chance to go to a conference where you'd meet scientists? Is there a chance to write a grant, to do a program together? You know, you sort of have your base as your career, but my career has been a lot of fun because I'll just try to get myself in the right place. Okay, get yourself to NASA. Mm-hmm. And then once they've hired you, start looking around and seeing who's doing something that you'd really rather be doing than what you're doing, right? Or I honestly have yet to have a job where I actually applied to a specific job ad. People got to know me, and then I said, you know, you really need someone to help with your communication strategy. And they're like, yeah. And then they wrote the job description for me. This is an interesting way to guide your career. Have people write job descriptions for you. Don't respond to ones that are written for other people. And realize that a lot of the job descriptions, I mean, you know, get comfortable with rejection because a lot of the job descriptions are written with someone in mind. And you may apply and they, oh, that's not the person we wanted. But then they think you're kind of neat. And this happens all the time. I meet people that are applying for jobs at NASA. I know who I want to hire already. But I meet somebody, I'm like, damn, they're really cool, and I keep their name, and I think about how we can use them later. So there's this wonderful sense of whether you're an artist or whether you're a scientist, keep that sneaky agenda in your head.
I think that's, yeah. I think that's terrific advice, and I think, you know, even this conference is a prime example, right? I wouldn't be here, they wouldn't ask me if I was not an accomplished filmmaker and writer. That's how I get invited. But then I get to sit next to these people and learn about what they do and meet them. And there aren't that many things like this conference. It's very unique. But again, I think that idea of sort of keeping your curiosity alive, keeping your reading and your asking questions and your meeting people outside of the narrow thing you do. And the other thing I would just add to what Michelle said is, I've been talking about, yesterday I went and spoke to a class here at CU. And one of the things that came up as I was just telling them the story of my career was that I have consistently jumped into jobs and opportunities that I was not qualified for. And my kind of mantra is I don't really say no to anything. So even if I, at this conference, found myself on a panel that I thought, oh my God, that has nothing to do with me. What will I say about this? I'll just show up and find out. I'll just worm my way into what I have to say about that. So I think that a lot of people feel this sense that in order to branch out or in order to take a risk or in order to say, wait, I could also do that, that they have to somehow have the qualifications to do so. And sometimes you just say yes and then you figure it out.
One other comment, if I could add something. What both of my fellow panel members have said is great. And I want to give a personal experience, but again, back up the idea of taking the jump, but maybe sometimes you need a base to jump from. The personal experience is I taught at Emory University. I had a lot of bright students. The most brilliant student was a woman who was still a playwright. She had started writing plays when she was 16. She took a course with me as a freshman. She was 18, wrote a wonderful play about physics. Extremely well done, and she's still a science playwright. So I'm very proud of her. But she also made me mad because I said, how come this 18-year-old can write a play and I can't? So I jumped in and wrote a play, and then wrote another play, and then wrote another play. None of them have made it on Broadway, but they were produced elsewhere, and it was a great thing for me. I didn't think I could do it, but I could. So I took the chance. But why could I take the chance? Well, I had a paycheck coming in because I worked at Emory, and that really helped. So if you have a firm base to jump from, sometimes that can lock you in the rut, but sometimes it gives you the freedom to try something that has some risk involved. So I just want to leave that final thought with you.
Great. There seems to be some interest in how can I get this Vanta Black, or why can't I get it? And
we use Vanta Black on spacecraft, actually. I mean, like he says, there's military and aerospace applications.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions was, does corporate control over intellectual property actually hinder the progress of scientific knowledge by limiting the tools available to humanity?
Yeah. Yes. You know, it's a difficult thing to answer, really, and this came up yesterday. I also had a meeting with a class of engineering students, which, by the way, went brilliantly. These kids were just wonderful. My hat's really off to all the engineering people here, judging by these students. They were phenomenal. And they asked basically the same question. And I said, well, I have a conflict of interest here because I write books, and my books are copyrighted. I put in blood, sweat, and tears to write my books, and I would like someone to buy them rather than to steal them. That's my conflict of interest. So I understand the importance of copyright and the importance of patents. I think patents properly used, and their initial intent was to encourage innovation by letting the guy who came up with the innovation get some benefits from it. It has now reached a point where you've heard of these people, patent trolls, who look through old patents to try to gain control and make money that way from other people's work. So when it reaches that point, this is clearly a bad thing for society. But the original idea of patents and copyrights, I think, makes sense. However, it will continue to erode just because of the Internet. There's no two ways about that.
I'm going to take the liberty to answer this question myself. So the question is, should we teach art and science together? What would that look like? And I'll invite you to do it. But there's a fabulous example, I think, here on campus. In my department, mechanical engineering, there's a young professor, Jean Hertzberg, and her specialty is fluid mechanics. Fluid mechanics is the study of how fluid flows, air and water, things. I hated that course myself, but she teaches a course, and she has for many years, called flow visualization. And half of her, it's a small class, half the class are from the art department, half are engineers. The idea is for the art students to learn something about the mechanics of fluid flow, and for the engineers to learn something about their aesthetic sensibilities. And the end product of the course, the final culmination, is a photograph that of depicting fluid flow, but in an artistic way. And if you have the time to walk over to the engineering center, a lot of these are blown up. You'll see them all over the. If you see these abstract, weird-looking things with multicolors and beautiful examples of the things, like if you've seen a drop of milk when it explodes and captured in just instant time. So anyway, that's just one example, but we probably want to hear from the panelists.
Well, I do have a couple of comments on that. One is, this reminded me of a great example of a science-art interaction. Jackson Pollock, you all know the name, was known as the artist. He upended art in his time because instead of slathering on paint on a vertical canvas, he dripped paint on a horizontal canvas. And this was brand new stuff. Well, about 3 years ago, a very high-powered group of fluid mechanical physicists and mathematicians analyzed his work. And they decided that, indeed, his stuff was not at all random splatters. If you do a fluid mechanical analysis, which is really quite high-powered math, it's very difficult math, you can show that he actually controlled the stream of the paint. So although the art critics will never accept this because they don't like to hear art commentary from scientists, the scientific viewpoint says Jackson Pollock operated quite differently from the way that we thought he did. Quite an interesting result. My own experience, you can smash things to get these things together in lots of courses. I've taught a science and art course 6 or 7 times, in which I combine everything from simple mechanics to quantum mechanics and bring in artistic elements. And even better, because this younger people respond best of all to this, I've taught a science and film course with a colleague in media studies, which is phenomenal. Most of the students who take it are liberal arts or art students who otherwise would not take anything beyond science, anything in science beyond one or two simple introductory courses. They walk away knowing something about DNA, something about atomic energy, and so on, just because we've exposed them to that in film and also in theater. So my answer is definitely, with the right person, you can make this happen.
Yeah, I would say for sure. And I think it really does, in some ways, depend on teachers who are open to working with their colleagues, to thinking outside of the narrow box of what they may have been told to teach. Actually, just hearing your story about kind of the sneaky approach, something just popped into my head that I haven't thought about in a long, long time. But when I was at Fairview High School here in Boulder, and I was in a physics class, and I had an ability for science, but I never really felt that it never really came easily to me. I could do it, and I could do well in it, but I had to work really hard. It wasn't really naturally the way my brain worked. So I was in this AP physics class, and we had to do a physics project. And I looked at all the projects, and I just wasn't really excited about any of them. And I went to my teacher, and I said, I want to make a project about the history of comets. And I don't want to get into the science of comets. I just want to look at how comets have been perceived, what's the mythology around them, what's the folklore around them. And I can't remember the teacher's name. I hope he's not here, because that would be terrible. But whoever he was, he said yes. And I really honor him for that, because he could have said no, that's not what the project is. And I ended up making this really incredible book that I think is still at my parents' house. That was like, I went into the library and I looked up like microfilm of old newspapers and images of comets, you know, through time, and stories about Mark Twain and all. I mean, it was fascinating stuff. And for me, with such an interest in storytelling, like it became about the stories that people have made about this mysterious phenomenon in the sky. I remember there was one year that there was a comet that was given credit for it being a great year for wine, and so all these winemakers were calling it the great comet wine of whatever year that was. So I had all this, and I just remember that teacher with great fondness, because he said, no one's ever done that before, but sure. And then because I think I did it well, you know, I got an A, I remember. And I remember getting the A and feeling like, okay, I did something that wasn't really the assignment, and it was still kind of, I still got that vote of support.
If I could answer that just very quickly a different way, I'm going to go back to being sneaky. I did the online, you know, which Harry Potter school are you? And I was totally Slytherin. And I'm a very kind person, but Slytherin represent. And if I can get closer to Alan Rickman, that's fine with me. But, you know, again, sneakiness. Science and arts are really under pressure right now as far as public school curriculum. They're being eliminated. Public school teachers are evaluated specifically on the reading and math scores of their students. And that means that we've had a harder and harder time getting our content into textbooks, into curriculum, into classrooms. And so at NASA, we've decided to get a little sneaky and obviously present the teachers with both writing and math exercises that use content from NASA. You know, can you write an essay about your favorite planet? Why? Can you talk about the history of people that worked in science? You know, can you do the mathematics to calculate the orbit of an asteroid? And we're really trying to figure out how we sneak our stuff into the curriculum. And another thing is art and science banding together. You know, we do a lot of art projects. I mean, you know, in after school groups, Girl Scouts, there's a huge art project. We're inviting artistic submissions about the Cassini mission, the mission around Saturn right now. And as arts and sciences are being drawn out of the public curriculum, you know, can we combine them and present the teachers with, here's a way you can get a little art and science together. You know, the artistic representation of physics, the planets, visualize your own exoplanet, all these things. We have people that are education specialists at NASA trying to figure out how to sneak this stuff in. And going in through math and reading is one way, and also banding together with art to kind of present it in another kind of sneaky way to get it to the kids.
Okay, great. Just a suggestion here, if there's some curiosity as to where some of our students come from. Anybody want to volunteer where those of you? Yeah. Oh, wow. Peru, Nebraska. And you came for this conference? Or? That's fantastic. Great. Anybody else? Any other students? Yes. Rockville, Maryland.
It's near Nassau.
Near Nassau, yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah. Not too far away.
Yeah, Netherland, Colorado, great. Excellent. Pardon? Palisade, Colorado. It's wonderful to see the diversity geographically as well as age-wise. A question here says, both science and art seem to require asking really good questions. In your opinion, what are the most intriguing questions to be asking at this point in time?
That's a tough one.
You know, the thing I always liked is that the simple question, the favorite question of every three-year-old, it should be the favorite question of everybody, is why. And I think the reason I became a physicist, even though perhaps my personality might have been more stereotypically art, is if you ask why like four times, you get to physics. of anything, right? Seriously. Yeah, why is the sky blue? That one's even faster. That's like you're right there, you know. But there's so many things right now that I'm so inspired by how little we know about the nature of reality. Seriously, we have so many things. Quantum teleportation is something you can look up yourself, but we're on the cusp, I think, of another revolution similar to Einstein, where we actually drop all notions of what reality is. I think we're very close to that. There are a lot of similarities in physics right now to about the turn of the century, about 1900. Where there were lots of things from separate scientists. And what Einstein did, I think Einstein is often misinterpreted. He was a brilliant, brilliant man, but he wasn't working in a vacuum. He took many different results from lots of people, and he brought them together and said, it's all the same thing. Look, all these great results, he brought them together. That's really his brilliance. And we're seeing a situation right now in physics where there's lots of inklings that there are different dimensions, that time isn't what we think it is. Quantum teleportation tells us there may be no real such thing as space. And my husband builds instruments that only work, and I'd be happy to talk about this offline. These are extremely hypersensitive quantum detectors that only work if you assume that there are multiple universes. And then if you assume that, the instrument works.
Wow.
So I think that we're in a wonderful time, and I would like to see how artists can help lead us to get rid of this very cognitive perception of space and time. Can artists help our culture embrace some of these new things that are coming?
So I would, I love that answer. It's very different, as I've said, from the way that my own mind works. So with the questions that consume me have to do largely with kind of the intersection of storytelling and psychology, which is why do people behave the way they behave, right? And I feel that we're also just at the beginning of understanding that, and also particularly the scientific aspects of that, which of our behaviors are influenced or determined by genes and which are not. But for me, those are the questions my mind goes to, and as I think about even our political situation, I can only filter it through my own lens, which is to try to understand why people are behaving as they are in order to achieve power, why that's working, what would make that stop working. So that's just, you know, my kind of, that's where my mind goes to the questions that I'm asking.
My reaction would be that science and art really ask exactly the same question, which is, why are we here and what are we meant to do here? The way scientists and artists arrive at answers are very individual, but they follow some of the same paths. One thing that you have to see is true if you think about it. Scientists observe what's going on around them very closely, and so do artists. If I had a visual aid here, I could show you a terrific painting by Vincent van Gogh. It's not one of the best known ones, but it's at a certain date in 1898 or 1899 when the Sun, Venus, and Mercury line up. He has that painted accurately. The rest of the painting is the Van Gogh style, which doesn't have a lot of science in it. It evokes a lot of feeling. He has the curly leaves and all the rest of it that says Van Gogh. But along with it, he did careful observation. So they're really, both science and art are human activities looking for the answer to the big question, why are we here? And can we explain where we're going? Along the way, the details are different. One more comment. I think the biggest question right now is, where will biotechnology take us? Just to get this down to the human level, questions about the origin of the cosmos and where it will end, quantum mechanics, all of that is really important and really deep. The one that will affect us most directly and very quickly, I think, is where is genetic engineering going to take us?
So We've been talking quite a bit about how does art influence science, and which stimulated, I think, this question. Didn't Star Trek influence science?
Technology, I think, definitely. I mean, it's some of these things, of course, may have happened anyway, but the idea, I mean, I think about communicators, right? I mean there's been a lot of cartoons that are really funny where Kirk and Spock have come to our time and they're looking at our smartphones and going, why don't our communicators do all of that? But the idea that you could easily communicate with anybody, instantaneously, I think that, certainly people wanted to make these things. They asked the question. I think we would have had that anyway because it just makes so much sense. But yes, I mean, I really, really wanted my Star Trek communicator. So there's lots of things in Star Trek I want. By the way, NASA does not have a warp drive. If you've seen that on the internet, that's bothering the hell out of me right now. We do not have a warp drive ship. I've seen that all over.
But you all know why Star Trek has teleportation in it, don't you? Do you know the story?
No, it's expensive.
they originally wanted to do it conventionally. Show scenes of spacecraft taking off and landing. It was too expensive to put on TV, so they came up with the transporter, much cheaper. But it generated some really good thinking, so it's a great idea.
I will say, for those of you that want to learn more about quantum teleportation, it is true teleportation. We're getting very good at teleporting atoms. It's very small-scale stuff, but an atom does not travel from one part, one place to the other. It actually disappears in one place and appears in the other. It's a really freaky thing. It's real at small scales now.
I have to thank Michelle for giving me the chance to put in a plug, because I wrote a book about that called Slow Light. Look it up on Amazon. You learn all about quantum teleportation.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll share the proceeds with...
Just take me out for a drink. That's all I want.
By the way, these sessions are recorded, so when Sydney just offered to share the proceeds, that's been captured on...
I'll take you all out for a drink. It'll be fun.
Are there any similar? Well, there are similarities and differences, but is there any difference really between a scientist and an artist? And where do their inspirations come from? That's kind of the question.
Michelle made a great point when she pointed out how much of science is intuitive, and I think surely that is true for artists. That's one huge similarity. Einstein first thought about the ideas that led to relativity by imagining himself riding on a light wave, looking over at another light wave. So it was a visual experience that later on he converted into hard science, quantitative science that you could prove with math and with an experiment. But the initial moment of creation was very intuitive and very visual. And I think that really was very close to an artistic moment.
It's interesting to me. I mean, when you, Michelle, you talked about, the three-year-old asking why, because, part of what breaks my heart when you talk about how these things are getting edged out of the curriculum is that, I mean, I have two small children, right? And this stuff, they're both primal, as is storytelling, I think. So, I mean, what do little kids do when they're not on devices? They draw, they paint, they ask why. I mean, those are some of the primal things. And the idea that we grow out of that, or we don't know how to foster that as we grow into adults, it kind of breaks my heart, because being around little kids, it's obviously they are both such a deep part of what makes us human.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I think it's the idea that there's something so primal about art and science and the why and the storytelling. I often really encourage people to think about self-curation, keeping yourself alive, keeping yourself curious. People often think of creativity as something that just appears out of the blue and strikes you like a lightning bolt. And people have no idea that you can practice it like a muscle. You can get better at being creative. You can get better at being inspired. You can get better at being curious. If you listen to what you are naturally curious about, even if it's not a very strong calling, you can curate that. As an artist, you can learn more about science. As a scientist, you can learn more about the arts, and you will be benefited just by the activity of your mind. Learning to be creative. I've worked with an artist called Nick Bantock for a while. He does. He did a book called. I'm gonna blank on this too, because it's this wonderful book about these two people that are in different universes that are trying to connect. But he's a very abstract artist, And, you know, he actually has a book, I think it's called The Trickster's Hat by Nick Bantock, where he takes you through exercises to try to get yourself more creative, try to exercise your creativity. So I think art and science both are a chance to curate yourself, your psyche, to keep your brain alive. And I think you can do that deliberately.
Great. Well, time is running to an end here. So I just want to ask the audience, have you enjoyed this panel today?
Good. I guess it's yes.
I have a follow-up question. Are you enjoying the CWA? Those are the right answers, because now I can encourage you, if you would like to keep this going, I would like to have you consider donating to the CWA. And there are a lot of ways you can do that. Don't worry about that. So anyway, thank you all for your attendance and for the great questions. And let's thank our panelists one more time.
Thank you.